In the coming week, the deadline for President Biden's 70% vaccination goal approaches. The UN Security Council votes on reauthorization of a crucial aid pipeline between Turkey and Syria, and the world marks UFO Day. It's July 1st, 2021, in time for the world next week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay.
Jim, this Sunday is U.S. Independence Day, and July 4th is also the deadline that the Biden administration set for having 70% of adult Americans at least partially vaccinated. But they already announced they are not going to meet that goal, so they have now said they would like to have 70% of all adults aged 27 or older with at least one dose of the vaccine by July 4th. This is coming at, as we hear, increasing number of reports about resistance to the vaccine, but also the dreaded Delta variant, which is spreading faster than previous versions of coronavirus, Jim. So what does it say about the path forward for vaccinating the U.S. and even the world?
What it says, Bob, is that the reopening that we're now experiencing is potentially in danger because a lot of Americans remain vulnerable to COVID. Now, when the Biden administration and public health experts talk about getting vaccine rates up to 70% or more, what they're interested in creating is so-called herd immunity. That is, having so many people vaccinated or immune to the virus because they've already been infected, that the virus can't efficiently transmit from person to person. Now, to be honest, no one knows what the precise percentage is to get herd immunity for the coronavirus. We've been operating with 70%, but some experts say it may need to be 75%, 80%, or even 85%. In this case, as with many other things related to the novel coronavirus, people are making educated guesses and then revising them as new information comes in. Now, you know that the Biden administration has fallen short of its target of getting at least 70% of adult Americans vaccinated, getting one shot. Now, that has not been because of supply constraints or because of government ineptitude. Quite the contrary, the United States, compared to most of the rest of the world, is awash in vaccines. The government has been remarkably effective in increasing the vaccine supply and getting the vaccine to people who want it. And that's the real problem. We're facing the problem of vaccine hesitancy, or maybe to be more accurate, really, vaccine refusal. The number of infections in the United States has gone down, but it's not at zero. The number of deaths has gone down. We're looking probably right now around 200 to 400 people dying a day of COVID. I'll note that virtually everyone who is dying from COVID today is unvaccinated. But the bigger issue is that when you look at vaccination rates, they vary dramatically across the country. If you look at the two coasts in northern parts of the country, vaccination rates are high. They're much lower in the south and the Midwest. So if you go to New England, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, Rhode Island, and Vermont are all over 60% vaccination rates for all residents. New Hampshire is the one exception there in New England. It's only, I think, about 55%. If you go to the south and look at Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, Tennessee, all of them report vaccination rates of the entire population below 40%. Mississippi is below 30%. Likewise, we don't have equal distribution across age groups. Young people are far less likely to get vaccinated than older people. I just saw a statistic that something like just 7% of North Carolinians between the ages of 18 and 24 are at least partially vaccinated. And of course, the danger here is that if people aren't vaccinated, they're going to be vulnerable to new, more transmissible variants like the Delta variant, or they may in fact become breeding grounds for new variants that could be more infectious or hopefully not more lethal. Meanwhile, Bob, if you look at the rest of the world, it's desperate for vaccines. Look at the continent of Africa. Fewer than 2% of Africans have been vaccinated. And so you have this real discontinuity in many parts of the world. People are desperate for vaccines, want to be treated. Whereas in the United States, we're trying to essentially bribe people to get vaccinated with things like free food, free beer, the right to enter into lotteries, and the rest. And there's real, I think, shame in that. Now, looking at the Biden administration, I will say that its more recent efforts on the global stage on this score have been better than its initial efforts. Last month, President Biden announced his plan to donate 500 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine across the world. Now, that sounds like a big number, but even if you have no spoilage, that just means 250 million vaccinated people. Remember, with Pfizer, you have to get two shots. And this is in a world of nearly 8 billion people. So it is maybe a great initiative, but it's certainly not an initiative that matches up to the threat we face. And again, this takes us back to a point we discussed, Bob, over the course of the podcast, which is that viruses travel across borders. Vaccinating Americans is not sufficient if people elsewhere in the world continue to get sick, variants emerge, because those viruses can come back here. But also, the United States as an economy is integrated into a global economy. If other countries are being forced to shut down because of COVID, that is going to redound certainly to the disadvantage of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, Jim, it's all a reminder that, as has been pointed out through this sort of healthcare crisis saga, it's as much an infodemic as it is a pandemic. And infodemic by way of there are people who continue to just not trust public authorities in the messaging that's coming out about the importance of vaccination, both for their own good, for their community's good, for the global community, and so forth. And so you have these just absolutely frustrating images of these vaccination clinics standing empty and throughout the U.S. And then you have places that are woefully under-equipped to give out the vaccines where you would have more receptivity to do so. And these are places that are seemingly getting ravaged by the latest major variant. I think it's now in 96 countries, which seems to be very communicable, although it does seem to be very much mitigated, if not blocked, by many of the major so-called Western-approved vaccines. I'm talking about the two-shot Moderna Pfizer versions or the Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca versions. It's, again, it's this confounding problem of public health messaging, but within countries like the United States, having everybody on the same page, wouldn't it have been a triumphant gesture to reach that 70% goal on the nation's birthday? And as you could palpably feel already, parts of the country opening up. And if for some reason this was going to go in the opposite direction and places are going to have to lock down again, that is just going to be just devastating, I think, for all sorts of reasons, but morale among them. And morale has become something that I think we're all acutely aware of now, Jim.
Well, certainly, Bob. And I think that is the risk. And again, it may be during the summer because people are outside that we won't see a surge, but we could see surges when we get to the fall and people are back indoors. I'll note that the Delta variant, again, this is the one that originated in India, is now present in all 50 states. And it is a real concern if people aren't getting vaccinated, that this is going to be a problem. And again, we were talking a moment ago about the United States being an economy tied into a broader global economy. But if you look at the U.S. national economy, it is the integration of a variety of states. So if, let's say, New England is booming because everyone's been vaccinated, case rates are low, death rates are low, that's good. But if what it means is that at the same time in the deep south, we see a surge in the fall or over the winter, that could disrupt those economies. And again, because trade goes back and forth, that could have ripple effects for others. I mean, we've been spending a lot of time talking about how there's been a shortage of semiconductors, and that has really sort of crimped global production. Automobile companies have had to reduce production because they can't get the semiconductors that they need. And this is the problem of living in an integrated economy where goods aren't all made in one place, but are assembled from parts made in many places. So this is something to keep an eye on. And I know that a lot of people are excited that we're returning to normal. You can just see it going out in the streets. It used to be even just 2 weeks ago here in downtown DC that people were wearing masks. Now I go out, no one's wearing masks. People, in essence, have said that the pandemic is over. They want to resume their lives. It's very easy to understand why. But we've seen in other countries, think India, think China, think Russia, that you can have the virus resurge, and that's a real problem. I don't want to be all gloom and doom, Bob. I want to leave you with a piece of good news, and that would be on the vaccine front. We've been very blessed with the success of the Moderna, the Pfizer, the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, and several others that are coming online. Of course, there's a broader question of whether they'll be resilient against variants that might emerge, but there's some work being done by people in the vaccination space, and they think that it's possible that in the not-too-distant future, we could actually develop a single-shot vaccine that will protect against all coronaviruses, past, present, and future. Now, again, still in the lab, still working on it, but you know, for all the doom and gloom in the here and now, there's some reason to think that at least when it comes to coronavirus, coronaviruses that the scientists may find a solution for us down the road.
All right, Jim, I'm going to take that positive news and sort of distill that for the weekend coming up. And again, we'd also note your opening comment about the real stark differences between this year and a year ago on the 4th of July weekend.
I am going to give thanks. 4th of July is my favorite holiday, and I can't wait to see the fireworks. But Bob, let's shift gears and turn our attention to the important debate in the UN Security Council. On July 10, the legal authorization permitting the border crossing in Bab al-Hawa, Syria, expires. This border crossing between Turkey and Syria is important because it is the last remaining crossing where UN-provided humanitarian aid can be transported into northwestern Syria. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently suggested that Russia would use its veto power on the Security Council to close the border crossing. Bob, why does Russia want this border crossing to be closed, and what impact could this have on delivering humanitarian aid to the region?
Yeah, Jim, it's a classic case in which both major sides, and that would be the Syrians backed by Russia, and I guess to some extent China, and the majority of other Security Council members are seeing what they call politicization of aid into a conflict region. In this case, Russia has been steadily lobbying to have the Syrian government exercise total control over all aid deliveries. It sees this as a challenge of Syrian sovereignty. This is echoing the Syrian regime's own language, obviously, and Russia's been a staunch supporter of Syria. And Foreign Minister Lavrov has said that, you know, Turkey or Turkish-backed rebels in Syria have been preventing aid deliveries, that they have tried to block aid deliveries into this northwestern Syrian enclave from Damascus and have been trying to manipulate the process and ensure that only this Turkish-originated route can be used. Syria would like to have control over and to use what they call cross-front corridors to deliver all aid. It obviously gives them a great deal of control. It gives them the ability, according to their detractors, of manipulating aid and blocking enclaves where rebels are believed to be, therefore also cutting off lots of civilians. We should note, as we have previously on this podcast, Jim, the Syrian government has been accused of some atrocious war crimes in terms of bombing mostly civilian areas, hospitals, using chemical weapons. Russia has aided them in this by many accounts. They deny this. And so it's really a fraught process. There's a great deal of concern given that this is not sorted out yet and we're getting close to this deadline. There's a real concern that the last of the UN the authorized UN corridors, aid corridors, could get closed up at least for a few days. And this is, you know, this is food stuff. This is supplies. It's sheltering material. It's also COVID vaccines. We were just talking about vaccines. The UN has the best capability of preserving these vaccines, whether they require special refrigeration or other means to get them into these areas. And the people who have kind of huddled in this last area, this sort of last redoubt of the rebels, are very vulnerable. They could be looking at what the UN Secretary General says is a catastrophic situation if they do not get this aid corridor renewed. It's a point through which we should note that something like 1,000 trucks move through every month. So this is significant. A lot of NGOs that work with the UN would prefer and have almost mandated that it be UN endorsed, otherwise they will not work with the Syrian government. That's something that also Russia has raised as a concern. So we're looking at a situation where within the next sort of 8 or 9 days, some sort of deal is going to have to emerge, or we're looking at yet another humanitarian crisis in Syria.
Bob, do we have any idea of what the outlines of a deal might be? Is there something that the Kremlin wants to avoid giving a veto?
At this point, it's been a pretty strong message that they want to just end this Turkish originated route. Like, they have not said we will be satisfied with this route if X, Y, and Z. From what I've read, Jim, it's more like it's time for the UN to get around an approach that supports aid corridors that come through Syrian government auspices as they would in many other countries in the world. We should note there have been over the last couple of years, there were three primary aid corridors coming internationally into Syria. Two of those have been closed. Some relief officials and human rights organizations have pointed out that when there was one that was heading into northeastern Syria from Iraq, after that was closed, the Syrian government had promised that it would be the provider of aid there. That has been a fraught process. It has not been as effective, shall we say, as the UN route. So it seems a little bit zero sum right now, Jim, but there could be things going on that we're not aware of. It's looming as one of the first major areas of crisis for Linda Thomas Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the UN, just in the position several months now. now. She herself traveled to the region earlier in June to get a firsthand look at what the challenges are there. I think she's working this issue hard. It's something where the five veto-wielding members of the Security Council are engaged in talks to try to sort out something among themselves. Typically, if they reach agreement, they are then able to message it to the rest of the council, and you get a what you want to get, which is a unanimous council endorsement of an aid corridor. This has been a fraught issue for the council since the civil war began 10 years ago, and Russia firmly came down on the side of the Syrian government amid, again, reported atrocities and rights abuses.
Bob, what has the Biden administration been saying about the situation in this aid corridor? You mentioned Ambassador Thomas Greenfield going there. Has the president spoken about it? Is it on the radar for the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken? What do we think Washington is going to be doing?
It looks like Washington is going to be hammering hard the need for humanitarian relief through UN auspices, Jim. We had a doubling down on that apparently in the past week in meetings that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken had with European counterparts and other major players in the region. He did announce something like $400 million or so in new U.S. aid to the area. And by the way, we should note that a lot of this UN aid comes through donations from, you know, governments like the United States, Japan, and the European Union. Russia and China have a lot to say about these issues, but they don't necessarily provide much by way of aid. They do provide a great deal of cover and sway for the Syrian regime to sort of get its positions expressed and endorsed, and sometimes veto other moves that they see as a challenge to their sovereignty. So I think you're going to see the Biden administration making a big case of this. They would like to get this smoothed out within the UN Security Council. Again, the Biden administration has said it is sort of refreshing and reinforcing U.S. work through multilateral organizations. They do want the Security Council to seem functional in this way. While at the same time, like the Obama administration, which was in office when the Syrian civil war started, the U.S. has sort of a shrinking footprint in Syria in terms of any sort of role in brokering a lasting peace deal there. That could change. We could see perhaps a fresh effort by the U.S. to get involved diplomatically. It's been on the sidelines for a while. So I think aid is where you're going to see the most emphasis at this point, Jim.
Okay, but we should be paying attention to this as a potential next immense humanitarian disaster.
Yeah, this is something that, again, these renewals have in the past been more pro forma. This is something that aid groups, and the ones that are most active in the region, have been flagging for a couple of months now. They've been seeing this as a real problem, and it looks like it's going to come to a head in the coming weeks. So worth watching. But Jim, I want to expand our horizons for a different sort of event in the coming week. That would be actually starting tomorrow, July 2nd, which is World UFO Day. Now, this was first observed back in 2001, so we got the 20th anniversary of World UFO Day. It commemorates an incident in Roswell, New Mexico in 1947, in which what was described as mysterious debris was discovered in the desert and sparked what became sort of global speculation about the visitation of aliens to the world. This year, World UFO Day follows the recent release of a 9-page unclassified report by the U.S. intelligence community on previous incidents of unidentified aerial phenomenons, or what are known as UAPs, another acronym for you. So, Jim, what does this report mean for our understanding of possible extraterrestrial life?
Bob, the report that Congress released late last month and had been prepared by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in coordination with Defense Department's Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force. Yes, there is in fact such a task force, didn't answer the question of whether or not extraterrestrial life exists. What the report did was to try to respond to an upsurge of concern and interest about what the U.S. government knows about these so-called UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. A number of us have been on YouTube and seen video that have been obtained by Navy pilots in particular showing things in the sky, doing things that they're physically not supposed to be able to do. And there has been a groundswell of support over the years, you know, for the government to disclose more. Again, you mentioned the Roswell incident. There have been books and movies and TV shows built around that. And I should also note that while we're talking about UFO Day being tomorrow, July 2nd, there are some people in the UFO community, if I can use that phrase, who actually celebrate UFO Day on June 24th, because that celebrates what is agreed upon as one of the first or the first sightings of an unidentified flying object. So I don't want to get into that discussion of June 24th versus July 2nd. But in some sense, UFOs or now UAPs have gone mainstream. People like John Podesta, former chief of staff to Bill Clinton, Harry Reid, former majority leader of the Senate, among among people sort of pushing for greater disclosure on this front. Hence, you got this requirement in the $2.3 trillion COVID-19 relief bill for the government to report on what is known. And if you look at the report, what you come away with is that there are a number of incidents that a scientist can't easily explain. The report suggests that these incidents can't be attributed simply to technical glitches, you know, interference from weather that causes sonar or radar to produce unusual results, that there's something that can't be explained. Now, having said that, it's important to say, and the report doesn't go into this, the fact that you can't explain something doesn't mean that you can therefore jump to the conclusion that it must be extraterrestrials that are causing it. So the fact that something is unexplained or unidentified doesn't mean that you can opt and say, okay, ET's behind.
Do you have a sense, Jim, whether we're getting more such sightings in recent days or recent years compared to, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, or that because of the widespread use of social media and YouTube and so forth, that people have more of an opportunity to say, check this out, or hey, look what was just made available or declassified or whatever, creating further buzz and fodder for the people who were shared around and maybe and keen to try to further the idea of a visitation?
I think the only answer to that question, Bob, is we don't know, because I don't know of anyone. And again, I have to confess, I am not a UFO, UAP aficionado expert. I don't know if there's an agreed upon database of sightings that has maintained over time with consistent methodological provisions to make sure the same things are being counted. But certainly there are a number of instances that are just not possible to explain based on what we know right now. And I think the report actually points to 18 incidents that it sort of puzzles experts looking at it. And so there is this question of what would account for it. Now, some people would argue that what is happening in these cases, let's say these 18 that sort of defy easy explanation, is it's not extraterrestrials. It may be a secret U.S. military operation, or, and this concerns some people, a secret Chinese or Russian military operation or technology. And that raises concerns about the United States falling behind in the military competition. You know, for those people of a certain age, you can remember when the United States was consumed with the missile gap falling behind the Soviets and that. Some people look at these data and say, what may be happening here is that the Chinese and Russians have mastered technology that we're not familiar with. I think the jury is out on all of these explanations, but it's interesting to follow, and it certainly gives people food for thought, or at least grist for interesting conversations around the barbecue on 4th of July weekend as you peer up into the sky and wonder if there's something up there that we aren't quite sure about. Let me just close by saying that when it comes to UFOs and life beyond Earth, according to Pew, 2 out of 3 Americans think that there is, in fact, intelligent life beyond Earth. Only 11% of American adults believe that UFOs reported by members of the U.S. military definitely serve as evidence of intelligent life beyond Earth. And what's really interesting is 50% of Americans don't think UFOs are a threat, and 36% of Americans say that UFOs represent a minor threat. So that's what we know from our public opinion searches.
And I look forward to the near future, Jim, a post on your blog listing the best UFO movies produced over the past 50 years. It's one of your best features.
I'm glad you suggested that, Bob, because starting next week, I'm going to resume picking movies, TV shows to watch. We'll do it for the rest of the summer. And I guess we will begin with best UFO movies.
And series, I would say X-Files might have to win that one, hands down.
I'm not sure I'll do TV series on this score precisely because it's pretty clear. It's the X-Files okay. And then everything else. But Bob, let's pivot and talk about our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, Bob, our audience selected 115 plus degrees in BC, Canada. I assume that's British Columbia, Canada. Bob, can you tell us why this is the audience's pick for the figure of the week?
Well, Jim, the audience has been transfixed, as have I, with these incredible numbers that are being recorded in the U.S., Pacific Northwest, and in Canada in particular, over what's called a heat dome, this phenomenon that's created this incredible concentration of heat. So I think that figure that the audience seized on was at the time a record. I believe it was in the town of Lytton, L Y CITTON, British Columbia. It was then broken the next day at recording something like 118 degrees. And then I think just yesterday, 120 degrees. So this is just sort of hard to fathom, frankly. It's just completely new territory. It is a phenomenon that, according to meteorological experts, that has created these conditions. But it's coming at a time when not just this particular part of North America, but, you know, Russia and South Asia and other parts of the world are recording sort of off the charts temperatures that are becoming more familiar now as we get into the summer months around the world, and raising big questions about what is happening here. What does this have to do with climate change? And what is the ability of communities to cope? You know, in the cases of British Columbia, one of the consequences has been a really serious spike in deaths or illnesses caused by the extreme weather. You have a part of the world where air conditioning is pretty scarce. They're just not used to having temperatures hot enough to require air conditioning. And you add to that just intense, you know, sort of Doha type temperatures, and it creates real problems. And so the most vulnerable people, as typical, are going to have a hard time responding to that. So I've seen figures in, you know, estimating in the hundreds of numbers of people who've died under these extreme conditions, Jim. This is going to create all sorts of new discussions about what sorts of resiliency are these communities going to need now going forward.
Well, Bob, is resilience going to be a sufficient response to this? I mean, resilience assumes that this is as bad as it gets. I mean, if this is something that is not just the harbinger of the future, but this is something that is going to get worse with time, either in terms of being more prolonged or getting even higher temperatures, this could fundamentally rework people's ways of living and where they can live.
Yeah. I mean, these are the types of discussions that have now been spawned by this, Jim, in terms of now. So a heat dome might not be something that's going to occur, you know, serially in the BC every June, but it is intense temperatures we're seeing in other northern locales as well. And this isn't to mention that, you know, the other places more southerly aren't also affected in various ways, whether it's, you know, drought conditions or whether it's flooding caused by intense storms. So it's a whole host of things, Jim. I think it's like, as we've reviewed before, as we've tried to sort of wrestle with at the Council on Foreign Relations, it's a whole host of things that have to be considered by policymakers. You've had the Biden administration come into office, you know, getting right away back into the Paris Climate Agreement and trying to set up a climate summit and trying to put climate forefront of the agenda. You're still seeing in the views of many climate policy wonks, what they see as a tepid response by major industrial powers to really changing the calculus in terms of carbon emitting energy, switching gears and going to renewables, cutting carbon use, doing the things that are going to need to be done to stop the acceleration of global temperatures. What we don't know, though, is whether or not the die has already been cast to such a degree that no matter what is attempted, there is going to be a new norm and a new sort of every year, a new levels of heat that are going to have to be dealt with. And then that gets back to this resiliency question. What is that going to mean? And what does it mean for the low-lying nations, the island nations who have tried to, you know, I think be at the forefront of the debates going on? They are vanishing, you know? And so it's a number of these things coming up, Jim. While you haven't had any sort of one single event that it seems to have focused, you know, the attentions of global policymakers, you are having an accumulation of them that's, I think, that is raising a lot of concern.
Bob, I'll just note on this resilience issue, and the reason I asked the question is I have seen forecasts for places like the Persian Gulf, where temperatures and humidity are going to be so high for certain periods of the year that they will essentially become uninhabitable, unlivable. And I don't think we've begun to wrap our head around this. But I would sort of push the point even further, which is that you mentioned the Biden administration wanting to rejoin Paris, having rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement. But we still haven't seen the U.S. government really step up and grapple with the enormity of the challenge that we face. Again, we keep getting warnings. I mean, it seems like every couple of months we have this conversation where we talk about something unusual happening weather-wise, hurricanes, fires, and the like, that clearly is sending us a signal that our climate is changing, yet governments don't respond. Yes, important to rejoin Paris, but rejoining Paris is not making a concrete change in how we operate. The Biden administration, at least initially, was talking about grand plans for infrastructure that were going to really sort of change our energy stock and the rest. All of those plans seem to have been scaled way back in the face of Republican opposition. And the final point is we tend to focus on these events that are really extreme, that are sudden, whether it's the fires in Australia or California, the hurricanes that ripped through a couple of years ago, or these heat domes, is the new phrase I guess we're using. But the slower grind of climate change is continuing. You already alluded to one instance of that is rising sea level, which is going to overwhelm low-lying island countries. But it's also leading to famine in many parts of the world. Very disturbing story today in the Washington Post about the island nation of Madagascar, which is basically on the precipice of what looks to be an absolutely catastrophic famine. It's been triggered largely by climate change, not by civil war or government unrest or government incompetence. It is simply that weather is changing and people can't adapt that fast. And this is happening to people who have contributed virtually nothing in terms of the heat-trapping gases that are driving climate change. Yet they're going to be the first to bear the brunt of what happens when climate changes.
You make a really good point, Jim, and it's the people who have smaller leverage at the big, you know, global conferences and forums where these things are discussed, and they're going to pay the price for years to come. There does, as you staked out, there remains a major divide in the United States, almost alone among major industrial powers on this issue, although it should be noted that important countries like Brazil, with the Bolsonaro government, is not seized of the issue as its predecessors had been, and this has had consequences for the Amazon and burning there and Amazon rainforest policies have been affected. So there's not anything like a global consensus, although there does seem to be a consensus among scientists about the concern. It hasn't translated into the policy concern by major global leaders. And so here we find ourselves just sort of notching one extreme incident after another, Jim. And I think we're looking at a summer where we're going to hit some other historic highs.
Sadly, I think you're correct, Bob.
And that's our look at the warming world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and German Chancellor Angela Merkel meet to discuss the post-Brexit UK-Germany relationship, and Chile's new constitutional convention meets for the first time in Santiago on Sunday.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guest, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks also go out to Anna Shortridge and Michael Kohler for their assistance. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long, and stay healthy out there.